You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
The Open Society Foundations have been funding work in the arts scene in the Arab region for more than a decade. We support the work of organizations like the Arab Fund for Arts and Culture, Al-Mawrid al-Thaqafi, and others, which in turn back the work of artists and cultural practitioners who bolster critical thinking, free expression in societies of the Arab region, which benefit very much from their activity and creativity. We do this because presenting the arts, poetry, photography, film, and performance is critical for the exploration of new ideas, challenging clichés, which is at the core of our mission supporting open societies. But artists in these societies also play a social role. Public intellectuals, they're respected social and even political figures, advancing free thought, representing change, leading and shaping debate. So I'm really pleased that we're able to welcome two speakers tonight, some I've known and worked with close up, and others I've just admired from afar and know less well. But let me introduce the two speakers to you, and then move to the program, which is going to be very rich with two multimedia presentations. So on my right is Osama Rifai, who is the executive director of the Arab Fund for Arts and Culture. I would say the leading independent funder of the arts in the Arab region today. He has a rich background working in the field for many years, and he has some great observations and insights to share with us, so I'm delighted he's here. On my left, we have Lara Baladi, internationally recognized multidisciplinary Egyptian artist, who's currently at the Open Documentary Lab of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And she'll be also giving us a short presentation after Osama's, and then we'll move to a conversation with the two of them and with you. So without further ado, I think I'm going to hand over to Osama.
Well, thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Sinai, and with that, for inviting me here to speak to you. There are lots of familiar faces in the audience there. You know, as Anthony has described, I'm just going to give you a brief overview of what we do at the Arab Fund for Arts and Culture, and then we'll talk a bit about the topic of today, art and conflict in today's context. So the Arab Fund for Arts and Culture was kind of founded in 2007, and the context at that time was the lack of public support for independent artistic production. And a group of, you know, independent practitioners from the region, together with some foundation here, got together to, you know, to start that initiative there. OSF was one of the main element there, and Anthony himself was a key player to this thing. OSF continues to support AFAQ, you know, throughout all of these years there. So throughout those 7-8 years, we have supported about, you know, more than 700 projects over the last years. And the idea is basically that we accept open, you know, we open calls on proposal online, and we accept projects that come from all the Arab countries in the region, 22 countries, as well as from Arab artists and practitioners that live abroad, that live in the Mahjer diaspora, the Arab diaspora. And as you can see on the picture there, we have a heavy concentration of both receiving projects from the Levant, as well as now more and more from the west of the Arab region there. And we're trying to engage more and more as now with the Gulf region there. As you can see, that there isn't much coming to us from that region there, although there's lots of projects now that are emerging and developing nicely over there. And you can see that we are also engage with the Arab diaspora in Europe, North America. We're trying now to do a bit more in South America. We started collaborating with a festival there just to tap into kind of the very large population of the diaspora there. Most of the projects that we work with, that we have supported so far, do have in a certain degree some sort of interaction between people working in the Arab region as well as outside. And you can see this very heavy vertical flow of exchange and interaction between the Arab region and North, you know, Europe and so on. And one of our main objectives is not only to sustain that, but also to encourage more kind of a horizontal flow of work between, you know, the Maghreb and the Mashriq and the Levant. Something that's going to be very relevant to what we're going to talk about later is the big youth bulge in the region that we are experiencing over there. So more than half of the population is less than 25 years of age. It goes all the way between 65% in countries like Yemen and Sudan, all the way to 50% as an average in many other countries. So more than half of the people in that region are less than 25 years of age. So that extrapolates a bit to the type of, you know, work that we have to do with this young kind of population there. Something that also that we do that is important is that more than half of the grantees that we get, people we give with funds to do their work, are emerging artists. That is, they're doing their first or second project. And this is a big risk that we take, and we're very happy to do that because that caters for launching talent, developing new ideas, especially catering for this very young population there. Most of the work that we fund are in the region there, but about 20% of Arab artists living in Europe that also receive this kind of support. So we open two calls for proposal twice per year for literature, visual arts, performing arts, music, cinema, and something we call regional events, training and archiving. We give a bit of fun to small festivals and workshops and so on. And I'm just gonna, as well as this, the general call for proposal, every once in a while we open up special programs that cater for a specific need. So since 2009, we worked on 3 years with the Sundance Documentary Institute on funding documentary projects. Over 3 years, we gave about 15 projects per year. And then we continued this initiative last year with the Ford Foundation on their Just Film initiative there. So we're continuing to fund documentary films because that's something very important today and what we're doing today. And I'm very happy also to talk about something that we've launched this year in partnership with the Magnum Foundation, which is a program for documentary photography. So I just came back from Lebanon. We just finished our first workshop, and that was a brilliant thing, exactly as brilliant as the launch that Susan taking part of. I'll go quickly through some of the projects we fund before we talk about art and conflict. So it goes all the way from helping Mashrou' Layla, which is an alternative rock band in Beirut, in Lebanon, to visual artists like Sabah Anna, who's doing her PhD in Colombia right now. Visual artists in Gaza, like Mohammed Hawajri, a rock band on the outskirts of Wahran in Algeria, performance artists in Beirut, like Ali Shahroor, and somebody you probably have heard of, Akram Za'atari, who has a permanent display at the MoMA, you know, one of his works. This is something that's going to be screened very soon. And it addresses all kind of topics like, you know, important things like sexual harassment in Tunis, and so on. So beyond just giving financial grants, we also do some professional support. So basically, we take some of the filmmakers to on the sidelines of international film festivals. So we go through workshops and we try to get them to talk to co-producers and to distributors and so on. We have taken some Arab composers to work with chamber orchestras, famous violinists in Europe as well. And we've hosted a few workshops in Beirut and Saudi Arabia, talking about film writing and so on. We've launched also a program for creative writing, novel creative writing in Lebanon and so on. What we try to do is we try to go to the peripheries of the art world so that we make our grants program available to places like Yemen, Libya, Saudi Arabia, and Algeria. So we conduct about 1 to 2 field trips per year. where we meet with the local artists and we try to tell them about what we do, how to offer the thing. And this allows us basically to continue to receive more and more from the outskirts, you know, the peripheries of the Arab world. So that's Libya, Tunis, Yemen, Saudi Arabia. And we just came back this year. We came back from Mauritania, where there's a very interesting cultural scene happening over there. And we publish once per month, we publish a grantee story and a couple of grantees' voices. So basically on the website, you can download those two pages of very short videos where the artists talk about their project and their own voices. And it is extremely, you know, it gives you, you know, an idea of this very rich complex that exists everywhere. And that's available over there. So, you know, we were asked to talk a bit about art and conflict today in the region. How does it affect cultural production? What are things that we notice, you know, around us and so on? And before we talk about this, it's very important, you know, to put things in context. You know, there are lots of unknowns, you know, in the region, as we hear about all the political turmoil and so on. But there are some givens that we can tell you about. One of them, the first one, is that this is an extraordinary moment in time in our Arab region there, and arts and culture is playing an extremely important role over there. That's one of the givens that we have. Second, this is a very fluid and transitional period, and everything we will talk about today is just one snapshot of what's happening today in the region there. So, the changing political situation that we are living is changing the rules of engagement of artists every day. So there's whatever we talk about today is going to become obsolete next week, next month, and so on. So we're looking at a series of snapshots of what's happening there. Thirdly, which is also very important, is that we are talking about a different variety of contexts. So what explains things in Egypt is not the same in Libya or in Yemen, etc. So that's a very huge diversity of context and community, sectarian diversity, and political systems, and so on. But what we know is that after, you know, the euphoria that we've experienced 2 years ago, 3 years ago with the Arab Spring, we're seeing now experiencing a very strong backlash, you know, on that kind of spontaneous outburst that happened 3 years ago. And people, you probably read about it in the New York Times, people say this is the difference, you know, what's happening right now is ISIS and SISI. ISIS is, you know, the Islamic State, you know, which is kind of one side of the total extremism that we're seeing there. And on the other side of the medal, we have the SISI, the Sisi type of phenomena in Egypt, where we have the, you know, dictatorial regimes and authoritarian regime that capture again the situation and do that. So that's something that artists are struggling with, are those two bipolar words, which is in most of the cases a very simple, you know, an oversimplification of what actually happens. So, you know, one of the phenomena is that after, you know, all of those years of repression and what happened, you know, in the 40 years before the Arab Spring, where, you know, all of the regime have crushed kind of the sensibilities and destroyed the spirits of people for so many period of time there, what actually this backlash is doing exactly the same thing. So we can expect that, you know, whatever we've seen in 2011, we're going to see some of that stuff happening again in the future there. And you can see that into the type of cultural production that's happening in the documentaries and in the narratives that you see in all over the place and so on. So, you know, one of the things that we characterize the situation today is what we call the state of permanent war. You know, basically, it's a condition of conflict that doesn't have a geographical or a temporal limit. It's really all over the place, and it's happening everywhere and every time. And beyond this immediate effects of fear, of violence, and destruction of human life, you know, there's a new phenomenon that is emerging, which is basically that the phenomena of the refugees. You know, this is something that is now critical. It's happening in many different places of the Arab region. There you have huge amounts of people that is basically have been displaced and are living economical misery as well as political misery, and they don't have, you know, any, you know, the basic safety, humanitarian safety requirements are not there. And artists, you're going to see lots of things coming out that we are seeing our ways that talks about all of these things there. So how does this affect the type of cultural production as we see today? So I've put it into five bullet points there. One of that is that artistic production is allowing us to see the conflict in an unusual way and in a complex way. And this is, that's refreshing compared to the oversimplification that you see in the mass media over the news and so on. That gives us kind of different perspective and allowing us to see a bit more the subtleties between what's happening there. So it's not only the ISIS or the Sisi, it's much more different nuances there. The second thing is that this representation of war and refugees and uneven geographies is becoming an urgent and omnipresent representation by artists today. So you're going to see lots of that coming out at the moment, right? And another third phenomena that we see also in art is that because of all of these disjunctions and all of these issues there, many artists have is now blurring, fact with reality. So you see lots of these production where you don't really know if this is something real or unreal, something imagined or something that has been lived and so on. A fourth element there, which is talks about, the idea of documentary in this condition there, is artists are becoming more involved into kind of documenting what they call real life, in the sense that they avoid the assumption of neutrality or the one of objectivity or simple transmission of facts. They cannot be just seeing that on a distance. They have to live this and they have to express a very personal subjective view of that thing. And all of these things are kind of have a background of generation that has looking at all the themes of identity and power conflicts. You see a lot about father and son, about the ruler and the ruled, about government and citizens, and so on. So that reflects a lot into the cultural production. Now, here and there, the overall overlying background to all this is a very strong sense of bitterness and disillusion. There's lots of disappointing that is coming out of this period of time after the euphoria that we have seen. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to show you three things right now. I'm going to show you a short trailer by young Yemeni filmmakers that talks about kind of the revolution in Yemen and how this created a mini revolution in her own family there. Then I'm going to talk to you about a documentary photography project by a Syrian young artist that has a series of pictures that he talks about. He calls them surrealism, surrealism situation there. And we just kind of basically are funding him now for the project and this new program, which talks about love in times of conflict. He talks about, kind of how is the conflict affecting the relationship of couples and refugees, Syrian refugees in Lebanon and elsewhere in Jordan and so on. And third, but not least, I'm going to show you the first exhibition by a young Lebanese visual artist called Adona Timani, which has a very kind of ironical way of looking at some of the contradiction that we see in Lebanon and elsewhere, in the Gulf and so on.
في اليمن تايمز صار أصحاب مرأة شاطرة ذكية جميلة عندهم زوجة
It's a very short excerpt. And this is a project by Omar Iman, a 35 years old Syrian photographer, and that's kind of his third project. So the first series is about what we talked about, the surrealism there. And we're gonna just let the pictures speak for themselves. And this is a series that he's kind of planning on doing, kind of love in times of conflict. And Dona is also a young artist there. She has kind of a critical perspective about what's happening around her in Lebanon, in Syria, and the Gulf countries, and so on. So she did her first. She comes from a different, totally different background. She's not a visual artist, and that's something that she just started recently. And one of her critiques is about the dehumanizations of refugees in Lebanon. Basically by this capturing by the commercial art market that actually takes those pictures and put them in galleries. We're going to speak about that tomorrow. and basically and just kind of takes out all of these human aspects from there. Another interesting one about is about the clash of power between different sects in Lebanon and, you know, in the Arab region in general there. And, you know, she's poking a bit fun at how these, you know, things looks a bit like you know, a ballet kind of engagement between those different things. And this one is a contrast between the denial of you know, the right of return of Palestinians in their own countries with the law of return in Israel for some of the people that are coming back there. This one about kind of the theme of, you know, very old, very familiar in New York about kind of the, you know, work, the conditions of migrant workers in the Gulf countries. And this one is the condition of domestic workers and also in the Arab region there, you know, how people are treated basically and how they are. And that sums it up a bit. This one she did kind of like about a month ago, and it's before her last thing. And she just basically, she talks, I don't know if you know the Smurfs, the Schtroumpf. This is kind of the Gargamel character of the Schtroumpf, that is kind of the very bad person there. And she, you know, she talks a bit about how we put stuff on the screens, it becomes a bit like, you know, a comedy. So, you know, I will leave, you know, the discussion, you know, we'll leave it to the discussion to talk about those artists and many others, but, you know, that gives you a bit kind of three different types of reaction of very young people that are kind of reacting to the conditions today. Lara, all yours.
Thank you, that was really nice. So my talk will be very, hopefully very brief. And I'll try to run through how, as an artist, I dealt with the last couple of years, a little bit before the revolution and until now, and how being in Egypt and having worked there for the last 20 years as an artist, how suddenly the revolution sort of changed things and forced me to rethink my position and to work in similar ways, yet in different ways. So just to give a little bit of a rewind, before 2011, I was part of a community of artists that was sort of benefiting from a critical mass on the art world and showing in lots of places. And one of the last works I did before the revolution, but not the last one, but one of the last one I did in Egypt was during the Cairo Biennial in 2008. The one before the last, before the revolution, the last one was 2010. And I built a tower which was inspired by the slums of Cairo, the informal architectural cities around Cairo. Which got the first prize at the Biennale because, of course, it was based on a military base. It was built on a military base in the opera grounds, and it created a lot of, you know, very dynamic response. I suddenly, when the revolution started, I found myself much more sort of frozen in a way. I mean, as a citizen, I participated immediately in Tahrir, but as an artist, I felt very much that there was a sort of pause and that suddenly everything I believed in or everything I thought was, you know, for me worked in terms of strategy, suddenly were being questioned and were being challenged. And I my first reaction was to, of course, to be a citizen and to participate, but I started to observe what was happening around me and how the creative flow and freedom of speech and this sort of dam that broke and let loose every voice possible amongst the random citizen to the artist suddenly gave way to a really impulsive and incredible spontaneous amount of works of arts that are, a lot of them amateurish, but a lot of them were using strategies of immediate response and immediate reaction. And so I met people in the square, and very spontaneously also, because I wasn't really thinking of art as I normally did. I participated in projects that were much more collective and that were completely improvised. And so the first one was Radio Tahrir, which was one of the free, free online radios, which didn't last very long as a project, but was a lot of fun and was part of this little period of time where we all were debating politics. So the Tahrir was an agora for, you know, how to engage with a new, with a new political landscape and how to bring democracy to the square. So this was a little bit of how Tahrir website looked like, and the Radio Tahrir looked like. And then a few months later, I did this project with the other people that are involved in media, Mosirin, which turned out to be Mosirin because they were still in the making at the time. So I worked with Khalid Abdallah, who's a filmmaker and founder of Mosirin. I worked with two, three other people that are also, that were at some point part of Mosirin. Some of them are not anymore. And we founded Tahrir Cinema. That was during the July sit-in, which was the second important sit-in after the first 18 days. There was two others. It's discussed how many sit-ins there's been since 18 days, but this is the second biggest one where there was a long period of sitting in the square. And of course, I'm a visual artist, and so I was really aware that we were going to be a long time in the square, and I felt that my role as an artist was to bring images or to work with images directly in the square. And I was very aware too that everybody was calling this the Facebook revolution and the Twitter revolution and so on and so forth, and that in fact Cairo and Egypt is not, the majority of people who participated in the revolution were not actually connected to the internet and were not on Facebook, and were just very simple people who were asking for a better life. And so I decided to bring a projection, to bring a screen to the square, and to show footage of what had actually happened since February. So we were in July, and it was a few months down the revolution, and this was the real first break of the sort of turning point of the revolution, where we were starting to be divided in terms of, you know, what was the role of the army and how was this going to develop and who was for the army and who didn't want the army and so on. And so it was an amazing time. I mean, you can see here there was approximately 200 people in average every day sitting around the screen. The screen was about maybe as big as the one you have. So, you know, we were all sitting together on plastic paper, plastic rolls on the floor. And it was an extraordinary atmosphere because you had the guy with the popcorn, you had somebody who had made home next to the screen and served tea every night. And so you had all kinds of activities around the cinema, which was really very touching and very human. And people would stand up in the middle of a projection and talk their story and what happened to them in this or that demonstration, how their friend got killed, or how they felt they didn't agree with someone who was saying something. And so it became like a kind of place for debate, while also it kind of calmed people down, because there was a lot of anger and there was a lot of anxiety going on about where was all this going. So this was a way of engaging with the revolution for me as a visual artist. We started building, and I had done this alone also since the first few days, as I was really fascinated with this visual production that was going on by so many people across the world. And Tahrir Cinema participated to building an archive on videos on the revolution. So from professional footage to amateur footage, from very high-tech cameras to mobile phone cameras. And this was done and much more focalized much later on by Moserin as a sort of media platform that was also later on training people on how to use their cameras and how to use their phones and how to edit small films and upload them on the internet and so on. And following Tahrir Cinema, I was filled with thousands, like a lot of us, I was filled with thousands of images and thousands of videos and, you know, information that I was just, I didn't know what to do with it anymore. I mean, I was just like, this is so extraordinary and so fascinating. And at the same time, I felt that there was for sure some sort of thread that could flow between and link all this production and all this, you know, Vox Populi production. And so I did research that was, while I compiled an archive of footage that was about the chronology of the revolution, as things were unfolding, I also compiled footage and documents that I found on the internet that was historical, philosophical, political speeches, excerpts from films, even songs, I mean, all kinds of material, a lot of articles from news articles, and images and so on. And I sort of built a parallel archive that was using or looking at resonance in history with what was happening in the square. So you would have the civil rights movement in the US, Fela Kuti in Nigeria, and a lot of other material that I started to work together with the footage from Tahrir and the square in general. So this is still from the three-channel video installation. And this is another one. And of course, I fell in YouTube as Alice fell in the hole. And for 2.5 years, from the 2011 to maybe end of 2013, I was almost, it was me and my computer. So it was really the time of my life where I've really created a connection with my computer in a way I had never before. And it's really changed my whole relationship to internet. It changed my whole relationship to also our understanding of our rights as citizens in terms of using internet, in terms of being in the world, in terms of a lot of things. And of course, this whole social media around it was also a very big dynamics in the revolution. That too was very new for me. So I, all of this was very exciting. And my friends left Egypt. A lot of people left Egypt. So my life was really sort of like focused between Tahrir and the internet, and so it gave results to this, which was sort of a healthy thing to do because it made me kind of like clear my head from all the stuff, while also be able to kind of move on to the next stage. Mm-hmm. And so the next stage is also a different stage in the revolution, and it's a stage where suddenly we have Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood leading Egypt, and a lot of things start to happen in terms of security, in terms of division of the people in Egypt, which was never something we never experienced. I mean, Egypt was one of the only country in the Arab world where we really had a sense of identity and unity that was maybe fake on a certain level, but however maintained for a very long time. And suddenly you had like all these voices that didn't agree and wanted something different out of the revolution. And of course everybody imaged it as a cake, and everyone wanted the biggest part of the cake or the whole cake. And so the Muslim Brotherhood was just like everybody else. And what came up during that period was that a lot of, which is a problem in society to begin with, but which sort of surfaced even more and in a much stronger way, and not just as a social issue, but as a political tool, sexual harassment. And so we watched, I'm trying to remember the correct numbers, I think the second year of the anniversary of the revolution, there was in one night more than 25 sexual harassment slash rapes, gang rapes in Tahrir. So that was quite outrageous. And through a whole year, there was more than 100, 200, and I can't count them, but it's become like, it was almost like an organized, there was something clearly organized. There was a sense of people were taking advantage of the situation while also using it to kind of bring women back to the back home and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of issues there that were quite aggressive. And walking in the street, I mean, I was never scared to walk in Cairo Street, but I was not scared either during the Muslim Brotherhood, but I was quite disgusted. I mean, there was no police, there was no military, it was a very strange space. There was no control, there was no sense of where are we, there was no definition of what was really going on, except a kind of very cheap anarchy going on. So it was a very uncomfortable time, and very depressing time, because from the euphoria, this was really the first break from believing or saying, okay, let's give the Brotherhood a chance. And then suddenly you realize that, you know, they have no idea what they're doing, and not only that, but they have an absolutely horrible way of perceiving the world. And so, of course, everybody was it was a very dark time. And so I made a sculpture that was, for me, also out of the archive that I had built, and which was bringing us this notion of being brought back to the medieval times. So I made a chastity belt, a giant chastity belt, which then people told me that, you know, was on top of Egypt's head. So this was how it felt, generally speaking. So the weird thing about this object is that while it's very erotic, it could also, you know, historically, it was also seen as a kind of proof of love for the one who left to the Crusades, and you would give him the key, and the woman would stay at home with the chastity belt as a proof of her faithfulness towards the man. But at the same time, there's this, of course, there's this prison, and this prison for me was very complex because it wasn't just about men putting women in a cage, but it was about it was putting myself in a cage. It was realizing and being very disturbed by the fact that I was in my own country, but I felt for the first time that in such a way that I had to almost put that prison onto myself so that I would feel more comfortable again. And this was really, really problematic. And then I did a work that was almost dealing with the same thing, but in a very opposite way, which was it was a weird situation, because while all this was going on, I got commissioned by Christian Dior to do a work for an exhibition called Miss Dior. Miss Dior was inspired by his sister, who was an activist and who was actually a resistant during the Second World War. So interestingly, she spent 3 years in jail, and then she was released after the war. And when she came out, he created this perfume for her, inspired by fireflies and the landscapes of the south of France. And so I made this video installation, which you can see maybe a little bit better here, which this is a still, and which is a surround sound installation. And it's basically a landscape of fireflies, and every firefly is a woman, and is a woman from the early 20th century and late 19th century cinema. But it's references, and it's only taking this sort of image of women who really have contributed to change the art field in which they worked, or have contributed to something in the world. And also in this sense of how fragile we are, as not just as women, but as human beings, and how also ephemeral we are. And so it was a sort of response to, you know, how dark those times were after the revolution, and how dark, in fact, the times were in France after the war. And when the German left, it's said to be the worst times, and how that time was, in fact, a very difficult economic time. So I made this correlation between the two, and sort of a tribute to women who, you know, rather than focus on, like with the chastity belt, on the oppression, I focused on, you know, how amazing it is to continue to fight and to believe in what one does. And so since 2013, back to a military regime. So we have Sisi, the lion, which means also the strong in Arabic, so it has that double sort of notion. And it's very difficult to work as an artist in this time. It's a very strange time. It's I think it's a little bit of, again, another in the process, a moment of pausing and of reflecting and of sort of asking oneself, okay, where are we? Because I'm not really sure where we are. And in a way, what I'm watching around me and what I've also involved myself in is to continue working with this archive that I've built since 2011. And taking this archiving as really as the possible act of resistance today. Archiving here, I'm not sure how clear this is. Oh, it's pretty clear. This is a very low resolution image, but this sense of in this moment today where we cannot go to the streets, we cannot really fight in the same ways that we could. And in fact, as artists in the art scene in Egypt, and having worked for 20 years now in that environment, I also think that it's a very poor time and it's a very difficult time because we do not have the same critical mass that we had 10 years ago and we do not have the structures that, for example, Lebanon benefits from. We do not have a very united art scene also. So there are a lot of projects, but they're not that connected to each other, sadly, not enough. And I think people are very fragile right now, and so are artists. And this time, not just in the art world, but also in general, in terms of who's participated in the revolution, the different initiatives in the media platforms such as Mosiri and others, the American University in Cairo, and so on and so forth, I could list 100, are archiving the revolution. Because there are so many issues connected to that. And one of them is, of course, the new government is trying to delete anything that's happened that has to do with that time, with Tahrir. So at the moment, we are in the middle of trying to release political prisoners from the prison. So I don't know if you follow, but Ala Abdel Fattah just got released. It's probably a political, manipulation. But there's all this time where we're sort of stuck. And I'm watching a lot of people leave the country. So it's another wave of people deserting Egypt, and when I say people, I say I'm only looking at the artists again. And so I watch a lot of filmmakers, a lot of young people, a lot of people who are more or less in the middle of their careers, who really are not willing to be patient for another 30 years or 10 years, and do not want to waste another 10 years of their life hoping for something they feel will not happen. So I'm part also of this group of people who are really concerned with archiving the revolution and also disturbed by this whole project, because it is a very complicated question, and it has a lot of aspects to it. There is the aspect that, of course, number one is to keep trace of that moment, because I don't believe it's over. I believe we're just in a process, and processes are always about two steps back and three steps forward and one step back and two steps forward, so that's okay. But I think something has started, and we have to believe that it has, and we have to believe that it has to continue, and that it will stop only if we stop. And then the other thing is that as symptomatic, I think Tahrir Square, when it was very sexy, everybody looked at it, but of course now it's not anymore, so people are, have moved on a little bit. However, it is an event that has been the most documented so far in the 21st century, in the digital age, and it's probably the one event that has the most information circulating around the internet and around all kinds of computers, loose or not loose, around the world. And I think that's a very fascinating question too. And that's where I am now. And I just came from Boston because I've just started a fellowship at MIT, spying on technologists and transmedia technologies to try and figure out where are we today in terms of archiving, and how could I do, as an artist, a piece that would combine art, documentary, and interactive archiving tools. And then, voila.
Thanks, both. For those of you who are standing, there are still some seats up front. Please, why don't you sit down? I wanted to, I'm going to start with a question to Osama, because you talked a little bit, and it connects a little bit with what I heard also from Lara about the present situation in Egypt. You talked about, you know, outreach in the periphery, and I know you've been traveling to Saudi Arabia, and you know the arts in a situation of very strict control can play a very disruptive function, play a disruptive role. And you know, when you think about, and you said that they weren't getting a lot of proposals from Saudi Arabia, from the Gulf, but you've been going a number of times to Saudi Arabia, and I wonder, because of course the situation's changed very dramatically in a place like Egypt, and where it was hugely permissive, and you know, you found it even disturbingly chaotic. There was a permissiveness and a freedom, and now they find themselves in a very different reality in Egypt. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what Afaq is finding, what you're seeing about the art scene in Saudi Arabia, and the function that the arts are playing there.
You know, initially when we went to Saudi Arabia about 2 years ago, it was the first impulse was one of fundraising. You know, there's lots of money there, the largest number of millionaires, and why shouldn't they be kind of taking care of an institution and doing a great job like Afaq was doing? And then, you know, when I did my first trip there, I started by, I went around and I started looking at some of the artists and the type of work they were doing there, and I met with a group of young filmmakers. You know, we call them now the YouTubers. I don't know if you're aware of this phenomenon, the YouTubers there. But Saudi Arabia has the highest penetration in terms of use of multimedia, in terms of traffic on Twitter and Facebook in the world. You know, it's kind of the highest number there. So I went to the office of those young guys, and it looked a bit like a Google office. You know, they had like those large iMacs, they had art hanging from the walls and things like this. And they were doing series of short films on YouTube that were having hits in the order of millions. So basically those guys were by themselves without a structure. There is no movie theaters, not one movie theater in Saudi Arabia is forbidden to have movie theaters there. They basically invented an industry for themselves where they were communicating with a very large audience. You know, we're talking about 5 million, 7 million of hits per each of these things, about social issues in very clever and disguised ways. They were talking about sexuality, about love before marriage. We're talking about many things there, but they're all very subtle with it. And we discovered that, you know, there's something interesting there in a place where there's little freedom and kind of it's the least kind of expected thing. Actually, there was this landscape of people producing, communicating with an audience, and talking about issues and so on. And we talked to those guys, and you know, they said basically, we don't need your money, Afaq, but can you maybe help us a bit by providing some training about, you know, creative documentaries and stuff like that. And we're running now a series of creative writing workshops for filmmakers. We've done a couple of them in Jeddah and Saudi Arabia there. And we're bringing, you know, kind of a mixture of Arab specialists as well as foreigners, and we're interfacing with these things. And there's some interesting stuff that is coming out of those things. At the same time, in visual arts, there has been a movement of kind of producing works that deal with issues of religion, of kind of taboos, and always something you never really know if they're critical of the regime or not, or the issue there. One famous something I like was a photography showing the original royal family, the Saud you know, the initial, you know, the guy who started the, you know, the Wahhabi in Saudi Arabia. And there's a picture of him sitting on a table with the Jedi from Star Wars. And this one was hanging in the wall of his office there. And I was really, you know, scared for him. I said, you know, what happens if somebody comes in and sees that? He said, there's no problem at all. I'm putting basically the wisest guy of Star Wars with the wisest, you know, person of our kingdom there. So, and I don't know whether you've seen that YouTube, No Woman, No Drive. Anybody? So basically, if you haven't seen it, you should just Google No Woman, No Drive. It just was, you know, had a million hits. There, after this became very public and went over the 6 million hits and so on, there were kind of three classes of people in Saudi Arabia. Some of them were kind of the very conservative. They were saying that this video was done by those young guys to convince women that it's not good to drive. And another third was saying, you know, they're just kind of making fun, poking fun at all of this closed system. And the other third didn't have a clue what these guys were doing. So kind of all of these guys play with that. So they, you see lots of expression trying to poke out within the limits of what they do. And it is creating some impact a bit on the world. Now, how does this relate to a political system that is now immune to change and stuff like that? I think, you know, we're in for the very long run. But definitely those expressions through visual arts, through cinemas, through documentaries, are having a very big audience. At some point in time, you know, probably this is going to translate into some sort of a change, social change in the structure of the country.
Thank you, Sama. So, Lara, obviously the period of the past 2 years has been one of extraordinary creativity and productivity for you as an artist, and you and responding to the kind of the situation, each of you really seeking to go out and engage with the audience. The installation in Tahrir, I mean, is a real sense of you being there with your public, performing, screening on an ongoing basis, and what a great idea that was. So you must have kind of had a sense of audience, of public, and of what they wanted, and there must be some articulation that you can give us about what you felt that they were expecting of you as an artist in that space, in that moment, and you know, how you felt you could respond to that, and how that's changed now, because the atmosphere in the country has changed along with it, and the leadership didn't just appear out of nowhere. There's that leadership is also responding to an audience. And they're giving a performance.
A very different one.
That's right, but they were all present there over these years. But they're also kind of giving a performance, a spectacle for the public's consumption. How is your kind of relationship with that Egyptian public changed, that sense of the audience's expectations over the past years?
I mean, Tahrir Cinema was very, it was really impulsive. It was really the spirit, for me, it was really the spirit of Tahrir. It was, I think that's what was beautiful about it. It was that moment where you're not thinking of who you are, what you're doing, or, you know, what other people are going to think, or, you know, it's so intense, and what is happening is so radical that it's extremely instinctive and intuitive. And for me, the response was that, and suddenly everything works out because it feels right. And so I wake up in the morning and I'm thinking, you know, I want to bring images to the square, but, you know, it's a very vague thing to think. And then 2 minutes later, I open Twitter and I see somebody saying we should project films in Tahrir. And then 5 minutes later, I tweet something and say, you know, is someone interested in doing this with me? And then next thing I know is that same night we have a screen and it's made of pieces of wood and plastic banner and just like junk, basically. And the response is immediate, and this was quite amazing. And this is when, for me, that was sort of clear, but it wasn't necessarily something I was, you know, I had time to sit and think about because we were responding so fast. But somehow, for me, it was obvious that not everybody was watching those incredible stuff that was circulating on the internet, because nobody is, because still most people were following TV and local, national TV. So even more important. So even more important to show them what the whole world said that we were actually exposed to, we were not. So for me, it was obvious that I had to bring the internet to the street. And I got not criticized, but I was a bit questioned by other artists and by people in the who came to Tahrir Cinema the first 2-3 days and asked me, like, why are you showing this? Everybody saw this already. I'm like, I don't think so. And it was right. It was very interesting to see that suddenly when I'm putting animation parodies of Mubarak and Ben Ali by Kharabish, for example, who are sort of political satire, animation political satire online, and all kinds of other stuff that came up at that in that period. Suddenly you have all these people who come from Upper Egypt, who come from Ena, which is more or less Middle Egypt, who come from different villages, who come from Suez, Alexandria, and all kinds of other places, you know, come and say, wow, when did that happen? You know, I didn't see that. And then also, they didn't see the battle of the Asrani Bridge, which is an iconic moment in the, on the 28th of January, which is when the, if you remember, when the demonstrators stopped and started to pray in front of the police barrage. I mean, we thought the whole world saw that, but in fact, a lot of people in the square hadn't seen those scenes because they were still watching the national media. And of course, the national media didn't show that. And so suddenly, it was like they were actually living the revolution suddenly again 6 months later in a very different way. And so their expectations was to see more and to talk more and to share more. And so they started to bring their footage. And so the next days, I had people from villages in Upper Egypt that had been there like in the last few days that came back to me and said, this is my USB, you know, can you take this? And can you give me what you showed me yesterday? And this is what the platform became. I mean, it was, that was one of the reasons why we did Tahrir Cinema, but it wasn't like we had a plan and we programmed and, you know, it was not at all like something we organized in advance or knew what was going to happen during the next year. No, it was like, let's do it now. And then, you know, do it as we do it. I love that. I think we think so too much about things most of the time. And I think it's very important to just do things. And, you know, and then you make it, you market it or you do whatever with it. But a lot of people create the container before the content. But it was really that. So I wasn't there as an artist. I didn't present myself as such. I, you know, it wasn't important. That was not what was important. And what was really important was to give people the possibility of expressing themselves. And so what was amazing was that every day we had a very different scenario. And by the end of Tahrir Cinema, we had a very extraordinary moment because it was like a day of like one of those days where 100 million things happen. And it was a Friday, and we knew it was probably the last one because 2-3 days later was going to be Ramadan. And probably the military was going to dismantle the city just before. And so the last Friday, which was the day where people came really to Tahrir, was announced that the Salafis would come to Tahrir. So it was like, da-da, the Salafis are coming. So on Thursday night, we're doing Tahrir Cinema, and then it's amazing. It's, you know, it creates a lot of discussions, and people cry and laugh and fight and argue. I was actually the one, I don't know why it was me, but I ended up being the one who was like the arbitrary person saying, you know, like, let's not fight. And so I was sort of controlling the crowd in a way. And so that night from 2 o'clock in the morning onwards, we started watching those buses of Salafis coming from all over Egypt and arriving in Tahrir with a guide. So it was really like tourists, you know, they came with a flag, and they had like 10, 15 people following them, and each guy with a flag was coming down from a bus with like 10, 15 people, and they just took Tahrir. And by the next day, it was like this invasion of Salafis, and it was really completely extraordinary. And we spent the whole day, a lot of us spent the whole day there, a lot of us left, got a little bit like scared of it. It was not exactly very nice. And I got kind of caught in the middle of it at midday, in the middle of the prayer, and it was a very strange moment. And I spent the whole day watching this sort of, you know, movement in and then movement out. So, you know, by the end of the afternoon, they all go back into their buses and they go back home. And we have to clean behind them. And we put Tahrir Cinema up that night. And of course, it was a very intense day. And so we showed a lot of things and we discussed a lot of what had happened during the day. And then 2 hours later, somebody came to me and said, you know, I'm Libyan and I'm here with 5 other Libyans. I'm from Benghazi and my tent is here. And, you know, I want to be in Tahrir because it's so amazing what Tahrir did. Can you show my film? And so we had this completely weird film from Libya, which was a mix of footage on Gaddafi from the 70s, 80s to 2011 with, you know, YouTube and all kinds of material that was mixed. And it was a very surreal film. But it was also extraordinary to watch these Libyans come and sort of declare what they felt about what Egypt had allowed them to do. So this was a very specific moment in time. And the people needed to have a sense of space, of freedom. You know, at the time, Tahrir was just a public space, really. I mean, I think what we oversee is that this revolution, for a moment, gives public space to people. And Tahrir was actually a place for people to come and bring their kids and walk around and feel a little bit free. You know, so what we take for granted in the West, which is to walk in the street, is not that obvious in cities like Cairo. Now, what do audiences want? I mean, the majority of Egyptians who are with Sisi are the sort of average Egyptian who want peace and want security and have very little means, but have just enough means and just have just managed to kind of come out of the water. So their head is out of the water and they just want their kids to have an okay life. And so these people don't want to hear about any criticism against the military. And they just don't, you know, they're just focalized on one idea and that's it. And so it's a very difficult and weird moment because you have almost like a counter-trauma situation where, you know, you're facing people who have like this fixed sense of what they want and what it is, and they're not going to change. And in fact, most of us are not going to change. I mean, most of us are like seeing something and we're not going to change the way we see. So the problem is not really to... I think what's important today in terms of audiences is to think of, to jump a generation and to respond to generations that are coming. And in fact, what was criticized about during the regime of Mubarak and all the other dictators' regimes was that the work wasn't done. So the social work wasn't done. The sort of the work on the ground wasn't done. And so there was no education, there was no NGOs communicating, there was all kinds of things missing. So it's really now that we need to do that. Because if we don't do this and if we don't learn from what happened, then we're just preparing for the next situation to be exactly the same, and again to not be ready to respond to it. So yes, we were not ready to respond to Tahrir, but we need now to prepare the next generation to respond to Tahrir, to the next Tahrir.
And your archive, your kind of memory project, in a way, is a...
It's very pretentious. I feel, I'm trying to make it less pretentious because I have an image in my head that is to create a kind of Guernica of the 21st century. So a sort of imprint or an image that will sort of fix Tahrir, or, you know, and it's a personal image, it's not at all meant to be That is history? No, it's not. It's my interpretation of a moment that I lived and that meant a lot to me. And I'm trying to do something that, while it's a tribute to that moment, and it will fix it in time, I hope, in a contemporary way, so it's not actually a fixed image, but it's a kind of movable image, a changing image, and it's not a film either, is also could also be used in its architectural frame for other conflicts, whether in the Arab world or elsewhere. And so really it's about a larger question of dealing with digital information and digital documentation of conflict today.
Difficult.
No, it's great. If I'm looking a little dazed, I just landed from Afghanistan last night, and it was the week in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and thinking about what you're saying in those contexts for me is very interesting. But I want to keep the focus in the room on the speakers and on the theme of the evening. So I'm going to open to you all if you'd like to have questions for our speakers. We have a microphone there, and just if you, I want to remind folks that we're recording the event this evening and for subsequent posting for eternity on our website in the internet, so that you're, when you speak, it means you agree to participate in that phenomenon. So if anybody would like to raise a hand, and just identify yourself and address the speakers.
Okay, my name is Neil Feldman. I'm the former Middle East specialist, trained in the School of Foreign Services at Georgetown. Now I'm an arts journalist, not working in politics at all. But I'm still aware of politics. And in that sense, in terms of the archive project you were talking about and Tahrir Square, have you thought about including in the archive a document that may perhaps be relevant, if not necessarily artistic, Field Marshal and now President Sisi came to America for training, advanced training in about 2005, and wrote some type of thesis about democracy, the role of democracy in the Arab world. And I'm not making this up.
He made it to me.
and this document is in fact publicly available, and it might be really interesting to get it downloaded and put it on your archive, evaluate it, and take it from there.
Sure, thank you for the information. I didn't know that, but I did start a kind of retroactive archiving. So when I started the archive, at the very first few days of the revolution, I tried to figure out who was doing what, and to map the activists and to understand where this was coming from and figure out, we all were doing this and trying to understand where did that start. And so in the archive, there's sort of anchors in time that lead to Tahrir. So that could be one. Thank you.
It's not that old.
No, I don't think that. I'm not going that far either.
I think this is sort of a segue in a way. Talking about your personal experience as an artist and then moving towards a more collaborative mode in Tahrir Square, etc., and now thinking that you collecting and archiving history and exactly following your point, what do you imagine? One thing is the shaping of it with subjectivity, but what about the collecting of it, and have you envisioned the collaborative participation, crowdsourced, without being fully overwhelmed, just aggregating and then
dissecting
and making sense of it,
which is a different
stage. So I'm interested in those two stages that you're considering in terms of your process.
So this was very much like a project that started very intuitively and very sort of as a reaction to what was happening. It wasn't at all like I wasn't planning to make an archive, but suddenly I found myself like with this load of information that I had started to archive, and it became an archive, and then it became a much more sort of active, it became much more focused as, okay, this is what I'm doing, so now I'm going to actually do it even more consciously and more, or in a more organized manner. And there's been stages of the project. So first it was really a way of dealing with the situation. It was very much my own way of dealing with the situation. And it was almost like keeping myself sane. And then it became suddenly a big archive, and then it grew and grew, and it became completely overwhelming. So suddenly it was really like, okay, what do I do with this, and when do I stop, when do I start, what do I include, what do I not? You know, obviously this is my choice of information, and it's going to be 0. I don't know what of what actually exists out there, if it still does, because a lot of it is gone in the bottom pit of the algorithm of Google. So no, it's true. You know, events like Tahrir live about 2 years on the internet, so in average. So a lot of it is already gone. So then at another stage of the project, I realize I come out of my hole and I start looking around again and seeing that, in fact, the big question is, okay, I've done this little archive because I do think it's a little archive. There's so many people and institutions and initiatives and groups and who have built archives, whether in Egypt, and I'm only taking Egypt. I mean, if we go out and go to Syria and Tunis and all these other places, we're like facing like massive amounts of people and institutions and collectives that have been building archives on different conflicts and revolutions and so on. So then part of my project is at the second stage or third stage or first stage, I'm not sure yet, is mapping archives, rather than try to say, this is my archive and I own the meaning of the revolution. No, I don't, and nobody does. And so really the subjectivity is a very important part of the project, because I do not pretend to know what exactly happened and to have gathered a very academic way this archive. It was very, you know, it's a personal choice. So it was very, it's a very private sort of relationship. It's almost like a love affair with the revolution. So this sense of archiving history becomes, there's a bigger question that comes in, which is how do we connect these archives together? Because today we don't have museums that will collect these digital archives. We don't have big enough machines. We don't have a decentralized system that allows us to navigate these different archives. And so the real question is, what is going to happen to all these digital files, and how are you going to access my archive, the American University of Cairo's archive, while the Mosserin archive is being organized, while I don't know who has an archive of just slogans or jokes of the revolution and so on and so forth. So really, I think these are fascinating questions, and they don't just apply to Egypt. They really apply to the world we live in general. And I'm excited about this at the moment.
Great. We'll take a couple of questions at a time now.
Great, thanks. My name is Nizar Habash. I'm a professor of computer science at NYU Abu Dhabi. And I'm interested in art, so I'm here. A quick, actually, comment to Lara. There's something called the Web Archive. It's a huge project. You may want to connect with them, and they're doing amazing work. But the question was about Afaq Moore. In the context of this evening about conflict and art, I was curious about work that's done inside of Israel or the West Bank by Palestinian artists who are, you know, Palestinian citizens, or Israeli citizens, or Palestinians in the West Bank, and how they're using art to make sense of the situation there.
Thank you. Excellent. Why don't you just pass the mic back to her, and we'll take some questions at once.
Thank you, Karen Yeager. And also on the same topic, I mean, the concept of an archive as an act of resistance is an extraordinary one. And many of us, most of us, have used archives, have dealt with the question of how you collect archives, how you preserve them. Should they be preserved digitally? Should they be preserved in paper format as well? Will they be preserved by universities, by libraries, who knows what? But what it does is create parallel histories through time, which is so extraordinary, because historians, of course, look through archives and often find materials from any era that had never been seen before and immediately change the concept of history or go off in parallel directions. So what you're doing is doing that, you're creating lateral histories and parallel histories, and you have the opportunity just with this concept and this terminology to reform everybody's understanding of making history.
That's a pretty scary situation.
But it's extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary. And talking about archives, it's been going on for a really long time already. You know, at the beginning of the digital age, when everybody became frightened about how quickly digitized materials would disappear, for instance. You know, how do you prevent that from happening? And how do you prevent the glut of materials from stopping the process of continuing to collect? But the other thing is, I wonder, in creating your archive or in gathering this material or in creating the materials, what is the influence that people feel, people that you know and have interacted with, feel about their creating and recording for local populations versus the world? And what is the mediation? Is there one level of objectivity that comes into your or other people's, as you might define it, gathering of material? Is it purely for your own or with your own understanding and need and connection? Or do you already mediate and see it as something that communicates with the local populations or with the world at large? And do those things, therefore, are they generated to record or to influence and change other people's attitudes as well, locally and internationally, let's say?
Thank you. Maybe, Sam, you want to take your question first?
Yeah. You know, I think archiving is probably the topic of the day, of tonight. Actually, that will answer a bit some of your question. You know, when we talk about archiving the Egyptian Revolution, the last 3 years, there's that much material. When you go to Palestine and you think about 70 years of history, there's even more. So there has been a lot of similar projects that have been done by Palestinian artists. There's a Radio Jerusalem project, there's a Radio Beirut in Beirut and stuff like that. So people have been, this was one form of resistance, if you like, to grasp the past and try to kind of comfort one's identity or to feel a bit, you know, that not everything has been lost. There is, in Palestine, we support many projects within the West Bank as well, you know, in Gaza. People who are kind of work in more provocative ways, you know, they're kind of more activist about what they do and how they think. So you have the whole gamut of project that you see there. There's not, you know, you cannot define it in one mode of operation there. There are lots of projects that deal with capacity buildings, you know, trying to really try to kind of give art and culture as an alternative, basically to feel that there's an identity, there's life that continues beyond the occupation and the current situation there. So there's not a simple answer to that. There's everything.
An answer from a very personal place to your question. I think each of us has a role or tries to have a role. And, I don't think I'm going to embrace every role that needs to be performed today to change things. So I tried to find in the last 3 years, and actually you say it was a very productive time, but for me, the first year, although, you know, Radio Tahrir, Tahrir Cinema, mm-hmm. all of this, it was actually a very painful time mm-hmm. and as an artist, because I really felt blocked. You know, in fact, for me, I mean, I don't see Tahrir Cinema as an art piece. I see it as an action, as a participation. I would never call it an art piece. It would be an insult to what it was and to what was going on. But and I really felt lost, you know, as a voice. I felt, where do I fit in all this? You know, like during Mubarak era, without really, you know, without really thinking about it in that way, I was very lucky to be very exposed as an artist internationally and nationally. I realized the first days of the revolution that the way I worked and the strategies I used were benefiting from the fact that the regime was stagnant, and were using that stagnancy of the regime as part of my strategies. So what I built and what I showed you was this tower that took 9 months to be built and to be destroyed, and so on. And suddenly I didn't know how to work, because I'm not of the generation that just like produces a video piece in 2 minutes, because I don't just sit on my computer and blah 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 and that's it. You know, I don't like it anyway. It's not my thing. You know, so it was a very disturbing time. And also, I'm of Lebanese origin. I've lived in France. I've studied in London. I went back to Egypt. My parents had already moved from Egypt, had left the revolution in the 50s, had been traumatized by it. I've been brought up in this trauma of the 50s revolution, you know. So going back to Egypt already was like a big no-no from my family side. And I've always sort of lived as a kind of free electron around Egypt. So I'm Egyptian, but I'm not, but I am, but I'm Lebanese, but I'm not, but I'm French, but I have an accent, but this and that. So my position has always been a little bit funny. And for me, this project of archiving is, and also always my sort of coming back to a more traditional way, or to my own traditional way of making art after these years of doing Tahrir cinema and so on, is really about, you know, I think things come from, you reconnect with yourself and then you try to bring something out. So I think the interesting thing for me in this project is to challenge the place from where creativity comes with an impact with your society, but in a different way than an art piece does, or the artworks that I've done so far do or did. And so I don't intend, I don't think I will touch the whole world. You know, you never do. Sometimes you do, but maybe, you know, I don't know. But that's not my goal in terms of, you know, that's not how I'm thinking of it. I'm interested in, and also I've collected essentially English, a lot of Arabic videos, but a lot of English text. So I know already that from my position, I cannot be objective. I mean, as a human being, you're not objective. But also from my position in how I belong in the kind of landscape of identities of Egypt, I'm not going to be objective. You know, I do not belong to the mass. I don't. So my interest, and I'm also aware that if I'm going to deal with technologies, I'm obviously not going to touch the people today who are illiterate, which are about 60% of the population in my country. So, you know, I'm very aware of that. But somebody's got to do something. And if this is what I know how to do, or what I will try to do, then I hope I will do it well.
Okay, we have time, I think, just for maybe one more.
One more, I'll make it quick. My name is Diane Wilde, and I'm a journalist in Connecticut. I just think that this is fascinating, but I'm conscious of it being a very hot button issue in Egypt for some people, because archives aren't always about art and history, but about politics and the future. And I should think you run head to head with trouble, and if not, why not? In this country, we have so many competing voices for image. We have the president himself, we have the government, we have the PR spin machine, we have a slew of journalists, many, many more than used to be. So do you come to this problem? Do people actually come to you from officialdom in some way, in a threatening way? If not you, then your young journalist, I mean, your young artist contingencies. Thanks.
In a way, this question is also part of suddenly the questions that are being raised when I'm developing this project, and what I'm now looking at is the possibility of creating an architecture frame that will hold archives, so that you know, I will not respond to one question, but a lot of people can respond to different questions and give different images of a similar event. Again, because of my situation as a weird free electron somewhere, somehow, and also because of the position of artists in general, and I would like to say a little word about that, somehow I feel invisible. So far, so good. So I've always managed to navigate politics and the political landscape in an invisible way. First, because I don't think art is that important in Egypt, and maybe in other Arab countries either. I don't see it. I mean, I'm not saying it's not important as we shouldn't do it, or it's not something that actually says something. I'm saying it's not important it's not important for the government. They're not really that interested in us. We're not that interesting because we're not that mediatic. So, you know, right now, artist, no artist, you know, it's more important to stop, to censor films, it's more important to censor political activists. First it was the Brotherhood, now it's the activists. You know, soon it will be our turn, but we don't know when. And I've been censored in Egypt. It's not that I haven't. I've been censored a couple of times in the Emirates and in Egypt. But most of the strategies I've developed during the Mubarak era, and also because of my personality or whatever, I also feel that, you know, I can be very provocative as a person, but as an artist, I don't feel that provocation is necessarily the way to bring across your message. So it's really also about how you say things and how you bring your message forward, which I think art is very good for that because it's a, I mean, already as a container, art is very good for that because it's in art you can put anything. So everything is art. So in a way you can hide in art because I'm not a journalist, so I'm not supposed to be objective. So I'm not a historian, so I'm not supposed to tell you what history was really like. So I'm an artist, I can do what I want, I'm free. So, you know,
As a result, though, you are quite a beacon of hope for people, and I think you're being very self-deprecatory here.
Thank you.
Great. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time together, but there's, I think, some good food left here, and wanting to stay a while, enjoy each other's company, and talk with our speakers, but let's give them a sign of applause.